This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can come to us via radio program at AOL.com. With us today is Layla Mudin, who is our nutritionist in residence. And she is my co-host for this weekly feature. If you're new to this, we answer all and sundry questions. You can send those questions to radio program at AOL.com. We don't mind, occasional comments on controversies like should we be vegan or should we be carnivores? There are many, many nutritional controversies that we often cover on these podcasts. All right. So how are you doing, Layla? What's up?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good. This is a headline that grabbed me this week. How Washington keeps America sick and fat.
Washington? And,
well, okay. I mean, okay. Got to blame somebody.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's not the fault. It's not individual responsibility. It's the government.
It's the government.
Blame the government.
Yeah.
Well, interesting though. I just did this is a little bit, I think, cribbed from the title of a book. And I interviewed the author a couple of weeks ago. It's called Sicker, Fatter, Poorer.
Mm.
Very interesting thesis. And it's actually about, specifically about, environmental pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're saying is that because, and this is also, I guess we can lay the responsibility to some extent at the doorstep of the government, is because of lax government regulations, we have a lot of pollutants in the environment, many of which are carcinogenic.
Yes.
That's the sicker part, but also obesogens.
Yes.
And
obesogens.
Hence, we perpetuate a cycle of poverty. Why? Because the very people who gravitate towards, you know, poor quality food,
mm-hmm.
foods that are laced with food additives,
yes.
Are often people sort of trapped in a cycle of poor diet and
mm-hmm.
illness and loss of productivity. And so we have an underclass, not just economic underclass, but a health underclass.
Yes.
So sicker, fatter, poorer. That's
yeah.
the thesis. I thought it encapsulated a pretty good concept. Here, what they're saying is the subtitle of this article in Politico.com, food is closely linked to health, yet federal nutrition research is underfunded, even as the costs of diet-related diseases are skyrocketing. Does Washington hold the key to solving the obesity crisis? What say you, Layla? Does Washington hold the key to solving our nation's nutrition crisis?
No. First of all, anything the government gets into gets worse. So, hello.
So, get the food pyramid.
Get the food pyramid out.
Right.
Get the USDA out. It's all about personal responsibility and personal choice.
Okay.
That should be where the locus of control is.
Yeah.
The government shouldn't be telling us what to eat and what not to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And what's available and what shouldn't be available.
So
it's up to us.
So you don't like our former mayor's initiative to restrict the size of the sodas that we could buy?
Mm. Well, it shouldn't be up to the mayor of New York to restrict the size of my soda. It should be up to me whether I'm even going to have that soda and what size.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're sort of taking a libertarian view of it.
Yes, I
actually personally... I didn't mind that initiative. I mean, on one hand, you know, I didn't mind it either.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I don't want to see anybody having a big gulp.
Right.
Or 32-ounce soda.
The soda that I don't drink anyway. Right. I don't want other people to drink it either.
But right. I want them to decide that they shouldn't drink it because it's not good for them.
Yeah.
So not because the mayor said so.
We're all about, you know, presenting the information, presenting the facts.
Yeah.
However, they say in this article, nutrition science has become such a low priority at NIH that the agency earlier this year proposed closing the only facility on its campus for highly controlled nutrition studies, a plan that is on hold after pushback from outside groups. I think, you know, there's something that this article isn't mentioning, unless I'm not getting it all,
you know,
is that they've done such a bad job.
Yes, yes.
That, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, why pour money down a rat hole?
Right. You know, back when I was an undergraduate, I remember my very excellent professors saying that the cleanest research grant money that you can get, the most unbiased, was from NIH. I don't think that's the case anymore. Not that the government would be biased. Mm-hmm. It's just that when you're a scientific researcher, you have to make sure, or somebody has to check and balance to make sure that your methodology is correct. Otherwise, our tax dollars, the grant money that is, you know, furthering your research, is really going down the tubes if you're doing bad scientific research.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
And scientific research that is...
It needs to be checked. And maybe it should be checked by a third party.
Yeah, because it's also, to some extent, it's agenda-driven. It's sometimes driven by activists on one side or another of a nutrition controversy. In other words, you know, vegetarian or plant-based individuals might vet out science that is supportive of their views.
Yeah.
And they might infiltrate the government agencies. Or conversely, you know, the Cattlemen's Association might, you know, try to put the kibosh on an article that is critical of red meat, or more famously, you know, the influence of the sugar industry.
Oh, yeah. The vegetable oil industry.
You know, where they basically said, you know, a little sugar is okay. We should emphasize exercise because as long as you exercise, you could drink, you know.
Coca-Cola had a millions-dollar campaign about you can drink Coke, you just have to exercise more.
And they influenced the government.
Right.
So,
right.
I don't know. Not that keen about this in an article in Politico. Here it is. But a growing number of critics are convinced the field is so flawed it requires a complete reboot. They include John Ioannidis.
Oh, yes, I remember him.
And he's the author of, remember the headline?
Yeah.
A study of studies show most studies are false.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he, you know, he basically said these studies which propose to answer questions like what should we eat, you know, the methodology is so flawed that we can, you know, can't really draw practical conclusions. We're torturing the data to try and come up with answers.
Yeah.
So he specializes in data science and clinical research. He's among the best known critics of scientific methodology.
I think so much integrity has gone out the window with a lot of scientific research, not all of it certainly, but enough for me to say, wow, I want my tax money back if any of this went through NIH's grant coffers.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
So here's a good quote from him. Ioannidis says, I've worked in many different fields, and it's hard to find another field that seems to be performing so poorly.
Yes. Agree. Yeah.
It does draw amazing attention in the news, these nutrition studies, but nothing seems to be validated. I can't think of any other field that has that constellation of failure.
Yeah.
So
there are other reasons that nutrition research is very poor. The reliance on FFQs, food frequency questionnaires, that's all about recall and recall bias, and you can't really depend on it. Do you remember, Dr. Hoffman, what you ate for dinner this time 3 years ago and for how long you were having that meal for through the end of the year? Who remembers any of that kind of thing? The other problem
I don't remember
with scientific
what we had
research,
last Tuesday.
Right. The other problem with scientific research is single nutrient studies.
Right.
Hard to do. It's like going into a forest and studying a single species when there are 400 more surrounding it,
right,
that is impacting it. How can you do a single nutrient
study? So we want to know
if
selenium prevents cancer.
Yeah. How do you do that in isolation?
Right.
Because the human body is not working in isolation.
Right.
How do you do that? I mean, when you really think about it.
That's why I actually like some of the more recent studies like Dr. Dale Bredesen did with patients with Alzheimer's, early Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment, using a multifactorial approach that's tailored to the individual. Now, that's not your traditional scientific study where they say, let's study one thing at a time and, you know, we'll do a double-blind placebo-controlled study. But, you know, what we do, we do a multiplicity of things with patients. And so, you know, I don't do an experiment like, okay, this week I'm going to give you vitamin D and you'll come back in 6 months and tell me if you're better. And then we'll after that experiment, we'll give you fish oil.
Right.
And then we'll see how you do for 6 months. And that, no, it's like, let's do a multifaceted approach. Let's see where your critical deficiencies are. Let's work on a, you know, sort of a, like an orchestral effect.
Yes.
As opposed to a single kazoo.
Right. And so many things work synergistically as well. You know, vitamin C recycles vitamin E and so forth. I mean, there's a whole synergy in nutrition, in biochemistry, in all of that. And how all of this works in our bodies depends on our unique biochemistries. How is your desaturase pathway working? Well, I don't know. Did I get enough magnesium today and B vitamins and zinc? Maybe your desaturase pathway is working better at converting your fatty acids. How do we measure these things reliably and come up with valid conclusions? I want to say it's almost impossible. How is that done? And again, this comes back to, I want my tax money back if this went out for research grants from poorly methodized research, really.
I think, you know, the headline is a little misleading. I think
so many headlines are.
Is that, you know, basically the thrust is the government doesn't allot enough money to nutritional research, and there is balance in the article because they say people have lost confidence. But you know, the subtitle of this article might be the public has lost confidence. There's not enough money in nutrition research. They deserve it.
Yeah. Listen, there is enough money in nutrition research. There has to be a third-party scientific, unbiased agency that needs to oversee the quality, the methodology, and make sure that what they're going to research, what they're going to study, is indeed going to be studied correctly, because I'm finding less and less in that. And I'm really disheartened.
And you and I should head that agency.
Yeah, we should. As a matter of fact, because you know what? You and I are so often left holding the bag of, Dr. Hoffman, Layla, what about this article? Should I stop taking my vitamin D? Should I stop taking my fish oil? I mean, we are always swooping in. To elucidate everything that was wrong with that particular research.
We do a lot of damage control.
Yeah. Exactly. So. And you know, I appreciate that that's part of what we have to do, because this is all about the truth and science. However, there is enough money allocated. It just needs to be filtered through a very knowledgeable, very intelligent, very scientific agency. So, yeah, maybe people like us. Okay.
Well,
I'm off my soapbox.
Okay, well, I'm off to the American Nutrition Association, and maybe they'll prove a resource that journalists and the government can turn to, because they're a group of very committed scientists, nutrition scientists, who are truth seekers, who are trying to cut through some of the bias and obfuscation and mystification that and commercialization that has occurred in the field of nutrition. So hopefully that research will continue in a way that doesn't confuse the public but enlightens the public.
It'd be very interesting to hear the highlights of that trip next week.
Well,
you'll be there.
Bring back a report, full report. San Diego, here I come. All right. Here we go. Let's answer questions. Radio program at AOL.com. It's a place to send questions. What do we have this week?
We have an email from Ed. I'd reported a couple months ago that I had a constant twitching in my left calf for 6 weeks. I'm 65-year-old male. Mm-hmm. Blood levels, everything is normal. After 3 months, the twitching continues.
Yeah.
I'm scheduled for an EMG.
Okay, so presumably he's been to a neurologist because that's a nerve problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, doctors to order EMGs are generally neurologists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Ed says I'm scheduled for an EMG. Will the EMG determine the cause of it, or is it more used to exclude other conditions? Mm-hmm. In your experience, Dr. Hoffman, is the twitching caused by stress and anxiety, or does it have a more specific reason, like a pinched nerve?
Well, it could be a lot of things. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to run the gamut of things that it could be.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, they're trying to rule out some kind of neurological disorder, okay,
yeah,
of which there are some where the manifestations might be twitching,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
But twitching is such a nonspecific and common complaint.
Yeah.
And it can indeed be due to a nerve compression,
mm-hmm,
which is not uncommon as you age. You might have an outlet syndrome where there's a nerve that exits from the foramina, which are the pathways that allow the spinal nerves to travel from the spinal cord to the legs and arms.
Mm-hmm.
And though there may be some pressure on a nerve, and sometimes it manifests as pain, and sometimes it manifests as weakness, and sometimes it manifests as twitching.
Hmm.
So it could be that. I mean, you could also invoke, you know, environmental toxicity. There's certain, nerve damaging environmental chemicals, although that would more affect the whole body rather than just one side at a time.
Yeah.
Could stress and, I mean, that's always the whipping boy of unexplained symptoms. It's, mm-hmm, just stress and anxiety. Just people tremble or they are tremulous when they're stressed. But it's probably not going to be just localized to one thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You ever see like a dog who's scared or apprehensive? The dog starts to shake.
Yes.
You know, tremble. Yeah. They tremble.
They tremble.
So, but that's usually a full body thing.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, rather than run the gamut, mm-hmm, of things, some of which could be alarming that this could be, but it's very unlikely that it is those things, mm-hmm, to the most prosaic, which is you got a pinched nerve or, you know,
Get that EMG, Ed.
From a nutritional standpoint, you know, what are tremors? Often are neuromuscular instability, which can be alleviated with
magnesium. Maybe even magnesium, a little calcium there, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sometimes even potassium, but.
Yes, electrolytes, yeah.
You know, there's, also some suggestion that tremor can be alleviated with CBD. I mean, what isn't CBD good for?
Honestly, yeah. We're talking a lot about CBD. Ed is asking, what are the odds this condition goes away suddenly as it appears, or could it last a lifetime?
Don't know. Could be,
yeah.
Why you're seeing a neurologist.
That's why you're seeing a neurologist.
But, you know, this is such a common complaint.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where chances are, at the end of an extensive and expensive workup, they'll just shrug your shoulders and say, well, it's not dangerous. It is what it is. Hope it's not too bothersome.
Right.
You know,
right.
do some stretching or something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Exactly. That kind of a thing. Ed, do email us and let us know what is found.
Yeah, don't keep us in suspense.
We would be very interested to see how you fare.
Yeah, we want to know an outcome here.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Find out what it turned out to be, because we don't have closure on this one.
Okay, I've got another very interesting question here from Susan. Actually, a couple of questions. I have IBS/microscopic colitis. I've had it since 1971.
Well, so, stop. This is a very interesting observation.
Mm-hmm.
Because they usually say, if you don't have colitis, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, and you have a lot of GI symptoms, ergo, you have IBS, which is a functional disorder.
Yeah.
But here's something where there's a little bit of an overlap syndrome.
Yeah.
You can't see the inflammation,
mm-hmm,
but when it's biopsied, probably this person had a colonoscopy and a biopsy, they say, oh, there's a little inflammation,
mm-hmm,
but it's microscopic. Macroscopic means you look with a scope and you say, ah, there's an ulcer. It's a, I think it's all red and there's a crater there.
Ulcerative colitis. Be bleeding.
Ulcerative colitis.
Right.
You can see it with the naked eye. Microscopic, you could, but it suggests mm-hmm. that there's a continuum mm-hmm. and that a certain number of people who have IBS have some inflammation. Mm-hmm. It's just, you can't see it. It's microscopic.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, we can use some of the same strategies we use for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, mm-hmm. which are dietary and mm-hmm. natural for this IBS, and we resolve that inflammation. But microscopic colitis is sometimes referred to as collagenous colitis.
Collagenous colitis, right. Okay.
So which we have several patients who have that. It's becoming a more popular diagnosis. Now that more people are getting scoped and they're getting biopsies.
Yeah.
And they're doing well, aren't they?
They are doing well. Now, Susan says, I recently had to get a full set of dentures because the Cipro and the Levaquin I took ruined my teeth.
Why did she
And that could
that?
Be that could be the reason for the microscopic colitis,
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Can devastate the intestinal tract.
Yeah. So
it ruined her teeth.
Right.
Oh my, that's a complication of those Phloxacin drugs
exactly.
that I have not even been made aware of.
Yeah. So because of the full dentures, she's swallowing a lot of the gunk that's used to hold it in her mouth. I feel swallowing all this affects my already aggravated guts.
Hold on. She has collagenous colitis or microscopic colitis, which is not necessarily the same.
Yeah.
And she's taking a dentifrice.
Yes.
Or a dental cement.
An adhesive to hold those dentures
which
in.
Which contains chemicals and microparticles.
Microparticles. Maybe things like anatase, titanium dioxide, something like that. Right? Yeah.
And she's having to put so much of that gunk there, it's getting into her intestinal tract.
Exactly. She's probably swallowing some of it. So I feel swallowing all this affects my already aggravated guts. Not one dentist
She's
or doctor
right.
will confirm this.
Oh, I'm confirming it.
You're confirming
it? I'll stand up for that.
It. Absolutely.
Just get me an ingredient list on the stuff that she's using for the dentures, and I'll probably find something that is an irritant or a microparticle.
Yeah.
Either a chemical irritant or a microparticle. Now, microparticles are... You know, you look at them under the microscope, and they look like little shards.
Mm-hmm.
like glass shards.
Yeah.
And they can be not chemical irritants, but physical irritants because of their jagged shape.
They kind of dagger your intestines that way. Now,
By the way, for any patient who has ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, or in this case, microscopic colitis, check the things you're using.
Yeah. Check what's in that adhesive.
I had a patient once mm-hmm. who did fine with ulcerative colitis. Mm-hmm. And I think it might have been Crohn's, but it was probably ulcerative colitis, who did fine and then had an exacerbation. Came in and said, you know, it's come back. And I said, well, you know, you got to stick to the diet. Oh, I've been sticking to the diet. Well, you got to take the supplement. Oh, I've been sticking to the supplements. Mm-hmm. I said, you're doing so well. Did anything change? Did you take antibiotics? Did you undergo a procedure of any kind? No, I mean, I don't know. I didn't think much of it, but I went through a teeth whitening procedure. Okay.
Oh, lots of abrasive stuff there that no doubt they swallowed some of it. And that caused
the exacerbation.
So, Susan's saying, what are your thoughts? Do you have any suggestions? I can't afford implants and wouldn't do them anyway because the antibiotics would be needed. And having had C. diff.
Oh, in addition, that's another gastro.
I'm not willing to.
That's a sign of like really a messed up gastrointestinal tract.
Yeah. So that C. diff is contributing to all of that. Wow. So, Susan, that's quite a lot. You want to look for a dental adhesive that doesn't have these microparticles.
Yeah, I wish I could recommend. Like that, I don't know.
My.
I mean, I would maybe consult with an integrative dentist.
Mm-hmm. A holistic dentist, biological dentist. And Susan then says, oh, and by the way, what advice might you have for pelvic organ prolapse that got way worse after C. diff?
Well, because of the diarrhea. Yeah, so she has a rectocele, probably like a rectal prolapse.
Wow, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, I mean, it sometimes needs to be a surgical fix for that.
Right. Well, with the microscopic colitis, your gut needs a cleanup, number one. You need to be on the right diet as well, which is the specific carbohydrate
diet.
Right,
start with that.
And then, you know, check and make sure you no longer have C. diff.
Right, because it persists.
Right.
If it's found, you might be a candidate for, you know,
fecal microbial
transfer, FMT, because it's not generally recommended for IBS. They are experimenting with treating that. They recently did a study on IBS with diarrhea,
yeah,
where they had very good results, mm-hmm, but the condition was that they had to get a super donor. And
what's a super donor?
Well, we don't quite know what a super donor is.
Somebody with excellent fecal matter.
The best poop ever. Blue ribbon poop. They get, you know, they go to like the county
Here
fair.
Here I come to save the day.
Right. It's like they're in a stockade and they get like this blue ribbon, you know, at the county fair. Super donor.
It reminds me of the poop emoji on the phone.
Right. It's like, well, that's right. It's a super donor. So, you know, but we don't even know what constitutes a super donor.
Yeah.
And we also don't know that there may be some hidden risks in apparently healthy people,
yes,
who may have good immune systems, but may be carriers of bad things.
Right, right.
So it's a very dicey thing. I mean, we have it down with blood transfusions now. It took us a while to figure out.
So you don't get hepatitis.
Well, not so much that, but, you know, the compatibilities, the ABO blood groups.
Right. Okay. Understandably. So that, okay.
But the poop is much more complicated than blood.
Mm-hmm. It is more complicated, right? I remember reading the story, I think it was in the Times, of a person, might have been in a Time magazine, person who found, you know, who had inflammatory bowel disease and kind of looked at some of his neighbors and said, "Hey, you look really healthy. Can I have some of your poop?"
Huh.
And did all of that and did all of this. It didn't turn out well.
There was a recent death.
Oh,
due to fecal transfer, and they did a really careful investigation of it,
mm-hmm,
and they found that an apparently healthy donor had some bad stuff, but also the recipient. And I don't understand why the recipient was very immunosuppressed. The recipient, mm-hmm, I think, who died was being prepared for a bone marrow transplant, which is a very immunosuppressive process. They give you chemo to really knock down your immune system,
mm-hmm,
so that you have virtually no immunity. But I don't know why
that can cause death.
But why would they give you a fecal transplant under those circumstances? That sounds like really a risky proposition.
Here, let's take away your entire army, and then we're going to invade you with this army. Fecal transplant. Wow.
Yeah. So they're doing they did a whole kind of soul searching retrospective on that. You know, like how did, like, you know, like a plane crash. Like, let's do, you know, a investigation of what went wrong that this now newly popularized procedure could kill someone, and, you know, lest we, you know, repeat that tragedy.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, we're time limited on part one.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So
wow.
let's preview what we're going to talk about in part two.
Okay. I have a very high fibrinogen.
Okay, we'll tackle high fibrinogen,
yes,
in part two when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. She's a nutritionist in residence, and it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.